Listen local.
This is Radio Catskill, and you are listening local, and we're about to get to the local edition, but before we do, we got to stop and talk to you for a moment. And by we, I mean me, and Cassie's still here, too. Hey, Cassie, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good.
So you're doing real good because you took phone calls, and we made the challenge.
Yeah, which is, like, super, super sweet because community radio is super important to me. You know, it informs the community. It provides news and information about local events, weather, traffic, that kind of thing, promotes local businesses, and also, most importantly, builds a sense of community. And that might be with the stories that the different radio stations tell, or radio programs tell. But also my favorite is the community of music and just kind of playing things that you might not normally hear on, you know, classic rock station or classical station or any of the other stations we have in the area. And
any station that's playing music, they almost usually play like one type of music.
It's
that's
true.
Like directed at one type of person, and that's not what our music programming is like here at all.
No, it could be like anything, and that's really exciting to someone like me who considers himself a lifelong learner. Yeah, someone asked the other day if this was like college radio, right? The other day, like, and I think it's kind of like that.
It's kind of like college radio.
Yeah.
You know, but for
even though we're not in college, but
grown-ups or non-college folks. Yeah, yeah. No, I see the connection there.
Yeah.
You know, I used to do youth radio and help like local teenagers make radio shows. And sometimes DJ and sometimes they do interviews and stuff. But people would try to say like, well, what is it? What's it like? And I'm like, it's a lot like the drama club. But like we're not putting out a play, like we're making radio,
right.
You know, but it's a similar vibe. It's a similar vibe to the drama club, you know, and band. I'm like, any of the things that the people didn't fit in anywhere and the really creative kids would do, like that's kind of what this is.
It's like without your face, it's like using your voice. And that's actually one of the main reasons why I started having a radio show, I guess, because it was like right at the beginning of COVID, remember? And we were like at the Jeffersonville place. And I was just trying to figure out like different ways to like use my voice and kind of expand my musical knowledge and stuff like that. And it was an experience, you know, talking on the radio show, like all through COVID and just being isolated. And it just made me feel connected to my community. And
I remember one show you had a voice break. You just come on like, and you just go, dang, stuff's getting weird out there.
That's exactly like, what it was.
I'm going to let folks know again, Cassie's still here for a little bit. She could take your call at 845-482-4141.
Call me.
Go to WJFFradio.org, WJFFradio.org. We're going to start the local edition in just 60 seconds. Stay with us.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And okay, I don't know about you, but at this point, I've got like Netflix, Hulu, HBO, Apple TV. And I bring this up here during the pledge drive because, of course, those places, they do not do pledge drives, right? Everybody who watches those services has to pay to get the shows. And I feel jealous, right? Like, it would be nice if we didn't have to interrupt programs to ask for money. If everybody actually paid, public radio would be swimming in money for ambitious programming. But of course, public radio is free. That's important, that it's free for everybody, for all the people who can't donate. If and when you decide to donate, you're keeping this radio station on the air for everyone who wants to listen, for the whole community. All of us who make these shows just want them to be out there for everyone. It's your donation that makes that possible. Here's how to pledge.
Keep Radio Catskill freely available to the entire community. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dolp. And coming up on the program, we're going to find out about Las Villas Project. Delve into the often overlooked history of Latino communities in the Catskills here in Latino Hispanic Heritage Month. That's coming up in the second half of the program. But first, as we barrel down to Election Day, it's time for our regular check-in with VoteBeat PA. And for that, we turn to Carter Walker, joining us live on the phone right now with some interesting reporting. Carter, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good. How are you?
Good, good. So let's just start off by jumping in. You said you have some data. Well, first I will say we talked to, you know, folks like the commissioners in Wayne and Pike County, and commissioners in Pennsylvania oversee the county elections. They play a role in that. And, you know, they one county commissioner always wants to reiterate, hey, you know, we can't start counting those mail ballots till Election Day. So be patient with us and things like that. And I've been spreading that word just to let people know, hey, everybody's going to be watching Pennsylvania on election night, but it might take some time to get some results. But you say that you've got some information that indicates counties might be doing well with counting their mail ballots. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of counties, you know, as you know, Pennsylvania didn't have universal mail voting until 2020. We had some absentee voting before that, but counties really got their first taste of large-scale mail voting in 2020. And the law, as you said, doesn't allow us to start processing those ballots before Election Day. Counties have to take the ballot out of one envelope, then out of a second envelope, and flatten it out so it can be scanned. And that takes a lot of time when you're talking about thousands of or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of ballots. And so that's a big reason why we saw this delay in 2020 for our results. And that's likely to happen again. But like you said, I did do some analysis that shows what a lot of election directors and even our Secretary of State have been saying, that counties have really gotten a lot better at this process since 2020. And, you know, even though we might not have all counties complete on election night, it's probably pretty likely that most of them are going to be complete on election. It's just going to be couple of these larger counties that are the holdover, but even them, they're probably not going to be a holdover as long as we saw in 2020.
Wow, that was just surprising to me to hear that. Were you surprised to see that?
Yeah, something that I was surprised about, particularly some of the disparities between counties. And just to give a little more info, what we did was I asked a couple of election directors. About 20% of the counties in our state, hey, when did you finish counting your mail ballots in 2020, in 2021, the November elections for the last 4 years, and then the number of ballots they had. And so with those two numbers, I can calculate a rate of how quickly they counted. And I figure, well, similar sized counties with similar resources are going to count at similar rates to these ones that I've collected data for. You know, a lot of election directors and folks who advocate in this space, like County Commissioners Association, will say, yeah, a lot of the counties are better. They are able to complete on election night. One of the things I'm finding most interesting that should be in a story we have out soon is that Allegheny County, which actually has a lot more mail voters typically than Philadelphia, they have been able to complete their mail ballot count on election night. They really run things very quickly over there. So that was surprising. But I think it's important to emphasize, though, that pre-canvassing, as the County Commissioners Association, which represents all the counties in the state, has pointed out, it's not just about wanting to get these results as quickly as possible. Of course, we all want to know who wins the race, and these mail ballots could make a difference in that if it's a really tight race. So it's not just about getting the results early, but also it's about allocating county resources. You know, for Allegheny to make it happen and get their results in on election night, they have to pull a ton of people from other county departments to come in and just help process these mail ballots over the course of the day. And, you know, that's a real burden on a county's operation. Counties obviously do a lot more than elections, so to ask entire departments, you know, to take off from their normal duties is going to put a strain on the other resources that, you know, citizens come to expect.
Yeah, absolutely. You say you were comparing data for similar size counties. In doing that, did you get any idea of how different size counties do, meaning like larger counties versus smaller counties?
Yeah, it is really the larger counties that will still have trouble getting through them on election day. You know, the ones in the southeast of the state, and that's largely just because of the volume that they have to deal with. You know, they have lots more mail ballots than a smaller county. Like, I witnessed firsthand the counting process up in Columbia County, which is in the northern part of the state, but not quite towards your region. I don't think And, you know, they do it pretty simply. They have these hand openers, just a couple of people sitting around a desk opening the ballots with hand slicers. And, you know, for them that works because they only have a couple of hundred or maybe a few thousand, less than 10,000 when I was there. So that, you know, that's not much of a burden for really anybody to get through. But when you get into those higher numbers, you know, 50,000, 100,000, 150,000 mail ballots, that's when, you know, you really got to start throwing resources at it, like high-speed envelope slicing machines and extraction machines that help you pull the ballot out of the envelope and that kind of thing. And Allegheny has shown it's possible to get that done pretty quickly, but it takes a tremendous resource commitment to do so. I think universally, regardless of whether or not it's possible to get done on election night, if you just throw resources at it, of course, there's no question it would be done on election night if you could start that processing before election day. And Jen, I should clarify, because election directors out there might be pulling their hair out if they say process, if they hear process ballots before election day, and people should know that does not mean count the ballots, it just means take them out of the envelopes, flatten them out so they can be scanned through, but not counting the votes before election day.
Right. Sort, but not count. Now, moving away from just the counting of the mail ballots, as you report on election in Pennsylvania, are there, and everybody knows anything can happen on election night. We all know that. Anything can happen on election day or after. But are there any other variables that you've got your eye on that might impact the count vote and how the vote count and how soon we get it from Pennsylvania? Is there anything else that's standing out to you across Pennsylvania that might impact that?
Yeah, well, it's really going to come down to the margin. You know, if when we had our governor's race in 2022, Governor Josh Shapiro blew his opponent out of the water, won by 14 or 15 points. And so obviously with a margin like that, with such a huge advantage in the number of in-person votes, well, I'm sorry, that did include mail ballots too, but when you have such a large margin, that's what's going to make whether or not these ballots, these mail ballots, really make a difference in calling a winner. You know, if we have a, if we had a margin of 500,000 votes, right, and there's only 250,000 mail ballots that still need to be counted, well, it doesn't really matter so much what those votes are because they're not going to overcome that margin. That is very, very unlikely to happen in Pennsylvania, just given how close polls have been and also how close the number of voters in each party is becoming. It's getting tighter and tighter each week as we move towards the voter registration deadline, which I know is something we've reported on and talked with your listeners about before.
Yeah, that the Democrats used to have an edge just because they had more voters registered, and then for various reasons that the Republicans are definitely catching up.
Yes, for sure. And that's continuing this week. And there's still one more week where folks can get in their voter registration applications. But I'm sure counties will still be processing those applications. We'll be seeing the numbers change as we move closer to Election Day.
Now, the last time we had you on last week, you were reporting on how the Pennsylvania Supreme Court basically ruled in two cases that it's too close to the election to change rules on the mail ballots. So that was it for the mail ballot cases at the Supreme Court level, at least in as far as this election goes. You did mention there's still a couple other cases out there. Since we last talked to you, have there been any other developments in these court cases?
Yeah, no new developments this week. But just to recap where everything stands, we have a case on whether or not counties are supposed to notify voters when they make a mistake on their mail ballot. That is still pending before the state Supreme Court. We have a case on whether or not if a voter makes a mistake on their mail ballot, can they go to their polling place, cast the provisional ballot, and have that provisional ballot counted. That one we could see a decision come any day now. And then, yes, the Supreme Court mail ballot dating case was thrown out by the court, saying it's just too close, we can't address this right now. But there was a caveat in that decision that we're not going to use our special authority to address this right now. But if it comes up through the normal court process, which is, you know, goes from the county level to the appellate court and then to the Supreme Court, they said they would address issues in that fashion. And there is still one case out of Philadelphia on dating the mail ballot that could get brought up to the Supreme Court before Election Day. Philadelphia had a special election for a state house district in September. And of course, you know, as always, some voters made voting or dating mistakes. So ACLU sued on their behalf, and we're seeing that in the Commonwealth Court now. Briefs, written arguments were due on that case today. So it's in the Commonwealth Court's hands now, and we might get a decision from them before Election Day, and then maybe we'll see it appealed up to the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, that it sounds confusing, but thank goodness that's why we've got you to make sure it's not confusing, because you're keeping a tab on all of these developments. And again, I'll remind people that they can follow your work at votebeat.org/Pennsylvania and follow the work of reporters like you working across the country on the state of elections. Again, that's votebeat.org. And we've been talking to Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA, and we'll be talking to him again. Carter, thank you so much for going over all this.
Absolutely. Anytime.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking about Las Villas Project. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Public radio is available to everyone for free, but we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters right now. Thanks.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
It's WJFFradio.org. Remember, all of our voting information is up there, too. Information on local elections, our guide to the candidates, WJFFradio.org, Election 2024 page. And when you get to WJFFradio.org to look up information about the election, why not make a donation that way as well? WJFFradio.org. This is a local edition. And Radio Catskill is delving into the rich and often overlooked history of Latino communities in the Catskills. Professor Brett Maney and Associate Professor Christina Perez Jimenez explore how Spanish and Latin American settlers established vibrant recreational communities with resorts and hotels in the late 19th century. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio, Maney, and Jimenez discussed the profound impacts and unique contribution of Latino artists, writers, and diverse nationalities to the region. And here's some of that conversation right now here on the Local Edition.
My name is Brett Maney, and I'm a professor of English at Lehman College, which is part of CUNY in the Bronx. I also teach at the CUNY Graduate Center. I study U.S. and American literature, the digital humanities, and I'm also a literary translator.
I'm an associate professor of English at Manhattan University, where I teach classes on Latinx and Caribbean cultures and literatures. And this year, I'm fortunate to be housed at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies, affiliated with CUNY, with Hunter College at the City University of New York, through a rooted and relational fellowship program.
That's great. Thank you so much for both agreeing to do this and be on the program, because this is a really great project I think both of you are working on. So before we get into the project, the Digital Humanities Project that you are both working on, let's just remind folks or inform folks, if they're not aware of what La Villas is all about and the Latino Catskills and the movement that happened here. Really began, from my research, in the 1920s. When the Spaniards started coming over here, right? Do you want to fill it in the rest of the
Absolutely.
History?
Absolutely. Part of what we're trying to do with this project is excavate and document and preserve this very long-standing history that has been a face about different Latinos coming up and Latin Americans and Spaniards coming up to the Catskills. I would say even earlier, from even the late 19th century, coming up to the Catskills and enjoying rural recreation in the region, enjoying the beauty of the region. And what is this sort of history commences at least at the late 19th century and continues all the way to the 1970s, even 1980s is like the end. Then there's different periods, just as there's been different waves of Latino migrants coming into New York and New York City more specifically. But what we see is that there has been a development of different types of lodgings and hotels and resorts that were owned and managed by fellow Spanish speakers, and that we're also specifically catering to a Latin American, Latino, and Spanish clientele. So they would have Latin music, Spanish food, and that has been a sort of constant from the late 19th century all the way to the 1970s and 80s. the presence of different resorts and vacation spaces for people to be relish and enjoy Latino culture up in the mountains.
And now, so how did you, Christina, and you, Brett, discover La Villa and the Saltino Cascos for yourselves? When did this come to your
I really appreciate that question. So I'm finishing a book manuscript. I'm finishing a book on the history of the Latino community in New York in the 1930s and 40s. So prior to the Puerto Rican mass migration, which so radically transformed the demographic and cultural stamp of Latinos in New York City. And when I was conducting my doctoral dissertation at Columbia, I'm writing specifically on Latinos in New York City within the urban scape. I kept finding all these sort of references to Latinos in the Catskills. And that was really surprising. I didn't know what to make of it, how they fit into the story I was telling of Latinos in this urban environment, getting used to this urban space that was so different from the Puerto Rico and the Cuba and the Spain they had left behind prior to their migration to New York. And I kept finding columns. I work a lot with archival materials, newspapers from the 1930s and 40s, documentary evidence, postcards, ephemera. And I kept finding the traces of Latino presence in the Catskills. And I kept the folder and kept dumping everything. And now as I'm finishing my book, I had the kind of space to really try to make sense of it and put the dots together and see how a narrative emerges that enhances how we understand Latino experiences in New York.
How about you, Brett?
Yeah, I think I can add to that a little bit by saying that in academic and popular accounts of Latino life in the Northeast, there's this real emphasis on work, on toil and hardship, specifically on urban hardships. When we think, for example, of the Puerto Rican experience in the kind of post-war era. And I think a lot of what Christina's research has shown, complemented by the intervention of other actors, and may get a chance to talk about a really important local historian named Ish Martinez, who has done groundbreaking work in both preserving the histories and also hanging on to the kind of archival materials associated with the Villas in the Plattekill area. But what Christina's kind of research is pointing to is ways in which this region was also a very important space for recreation, for leisure, for musical appreciation, for creating cross-ethnic ties, for thinking about a longer Latino genealogy in the area that complements and also in a way challenges stories about the sort of Latino Northeast when they only focus on the city. We see, for example, in the outreach and work that we've done, so many stories of people who are often in their 60s and 70s today in the city who have these really important memories of taking bus tours up to the Catskills in the 70s and the 60s, or who relocated there and for whom these were really formative experiences and thinking about their identity as New Yorkers and as Latino New Yorkers.
It is great that there is this history that I guess, like, for me personally, I didn't know anything about the Latinos Catskills coming up here. I'm originally from the city and moved up here to the Catskills, and we're home with the Borscht Belt, and I'm hearing all of that. But every once in a while, I hear about the Latinos coming up here, and I always hear them as hotel workers. And then someone pointed out your project a while back, and I was like, wow, there was a sort of a quote unquote Borscht Belt for the Latinos type of deal. And just realizing that the history, because I'm just personally interested in it because my mother came from Puerto Rico, my father's from Ecuador. And they came up here in the late 60s, 70s, working in the factories during the whole diaspora of Puerto Ricans coming here, like I said, right after the war. And so now that this community came up here and really enjoying the area, really bringing the music there, and especially towards the late 60s, really bringing the music coming here, not creating salsa, but I guess melding the bombo and all the dances there. So let's talk about this project now that you are both working on, the Latino Catskills project.
How did that come about? Can I interrupt you for a second? I love the comparison that you've made, or the reference to the Borscht Belt, because I think that's an important point of comparison and relation, thinking more broadly about the ethnic Catskills and the Catskills as this important place for the formation of ethnic American identity. And I think there's a lot of really rich and productive comparison to be made to thinking about the presence of Spanish speakers, of Latinos and Latin Americans in the Catskills, and that longstanding sort of stamp of Jewish American culture on the Catskills, how important the Catskills has been for Jewish American identity formation. And I think there's so many parallels, the ways that the Catskills provided, the resorts, that Villas provided, just like the Borscht Belt provided, this sort of welcoming environment, a sense of community, allowing these ethnic families to relax, to celebrate their heritage without a fear of discrimination, right? This is a time in which perhaps they weren't welcomed in many other locales, how they facilitated these sort of social connections, families coming together, having a sense of shared identity, a place to celebrate and strengthen one's culture through music and food. And you mentioned the music, and I think that probably is the most sort of direct link and bridge between the Borscht Belt and the Latino Catskills broadly, or more specifically Las Villas in the Platalkill region, in that musicians often would go play in the Borscht Belt and the big resorts. There was a moment, there was a mambo craze and there was like the Latin fever. There were a lot of Latin musicians playing up in the Borscht Belt. And then they would come down and also play in Las Villas, right? So they serve as a sort of, as bridging cultural figures. But thinking about Latino Catskills, just like the Borscht Belt, as not just a place of where you vacation, but really a place where you develop a sense of belonging, right? And shared identity. And lastly, sort of, I wanted to mention that the comparison between Las Villas and the Borscht Belt is not idiosyncratic or synchronistic. It's not that in the late 1960s, the New York Times had an article where it explicitly was talking about what they called the Spanish Alps and then the Puerto Rican Alps in reference to the region, which are wonderful terms. But the New York Times explained or translated to its readership Las Villas as the Latin counterpart to the Jewish Borscht Belt. Right. So that was like a direct quote from the New York Times from the late 1960s, seeing Las Villas and as a Latin counterpart to the Jewish Borscht Belt. So it's a very interesting point of connection and a lot to explore there.
I was going to ask you about that, because so I see you both as experts on this topic here, because the Borscht Belt was really born out of discrimination of these folks. These ethnic groups weren't allowed in certain places, so they created their own place. And so it could be around folks that are like them. And I was wondering whether that, with the Las Villas and the Latino Catskills, did that also come out of that type of thing that maybe Latinos weren't allowed in certain places, and discovering that, hey, I could create an area for ourselves and to feel, you know, empowered. Or like, perfect example is when I first went to Spain. I'm not Spanish. I'm born here in America, Puerto Rican, Ecuadorian. It was the first time in my life that I felt, or even when I went to Puerto Rico for the first time, it felt really empowering feeling for me to be about people who look like me, who speak Spanish, and everything was in Spanish, and it was all Spanish people. And I don't know how to describe it. It just felt so empowering in a way. And I'm wondering if that was the sentiment also for these people back in the late 20s, 60s, and 70s.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think necessarily there was the jure segregation in which by law Puerto Ricans were not welcome, right, or Latinos and Latin Americans weren't welcome in certain establishment. But by de facto, that feeling of being part of a community, of being welcome, of feeling your food, your music, your culture, your language is represented. I think that sense of belonging was a crucial part of what made the Villa so attractive a place to celebrate one's roots. With the early formation of the Villas, I think it also has to do with the fact that many of these migrants had ties to the land prior to migrating, right? A lot of them were farmers. In the case of Spaniards, a lot of them live near apple, you know, orchards and have a tradition of making sidra, cider, that is wonderful. So when they were moving from New York City and then going up to the Catskills, it was a way of, they couldn't go back to the homeland. So going back to the land and going back to the Catskills was a sort of substitute, right, for that return to the homeland. And that's a sentiment, I will say, that continues all the way until the 1960s and 70s. The New York Times and another piece in the late 60s quotes Shorty Martinez, who was the owner of Sunny Acres Hotel and the father of the scholar Ish Martinez, who has done wonderful work. I would love our listeners to check out his excellent book. It's on Amazon and bookshop called Las Villas. But in this article, they quote his father saying, "Why do we have to go back to Puerto Rico when we have the island right here in the Spanish Alps?" There's a sense of a return to the land becomes a kind of substitute as a return to the homeland, a sense of belonging, permanence, and being welcomed.
Thank you to Patricio for that conversation about Las Villas. That's a much longer conversation. That's just an excerpt. You can hear the full thing. Go to wjffradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org, which not coincidentally is where you can also go to make your donation. Help us out during our fall fun drive. Thank you to everybody that's helped us out so far. If you have not and you have something to give, we need to hear from you now. Give now. WJFFradio.org. We got the